This is Digital Story Podcast number 1012, August 12, 2025. Today's theme is How It All Began. I'm Derek Story. I'm one of those odd folks who always knew what I wanted to do for a living. As a kid, I tormented my parents with requests to the Photoshop for supplies to brew the alchemy for my own film processing. Then in junior high, I got my big break. And that's how we lead off today's TVS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. So yes, as a kid, I just loved photography. It fascinated me. I had a Brownie Starmite 127 film camera, and I was quite the terror with it. I took it everywhere. And that 127 film is a nice size because you could make contact prints with it, and the prints were pretty cute. They were a lot like the little Instax prints that you make today from a digital film printer. So I didn't need an enlarger in my makeshift darkroom that was in the garage. I could just do contact prints from the film that I developed. And it was a fascinating endeavor, and I followed it for years. I had a great uncle who was an artist and who actually wrote for Cracked magazine. I don't know if anyone remembers that far back. His name was Don Swanson, and he was a tremendous talent, and he was interested in all sorts of things: art, science, photography, music. He was truly a Renaissance man, and he gave me my first 35 millimeter camera, which was an Argus C3. And that is, I have to say, to this day, one of the more Mr. Gadget looking cameras I've ever seen. I mean, the gears were literally on the outside of the camera. I had a couple lenses for it, and it was a box, and it was a boxy box, but it held 35 millimeter film. And if you could wrangle it properly, it took relatively good photos. So that's what leads me up to the subject of today's podcast, which is how it all really began, how the career began. Now, I've been talking about my love for photography, which has persisted ever since I was a young lad, but the career began in junior high. Now, some of you may have heard this story at workshops or other places. I may even have alluded to it in earlier podcasts. You know what happens after 1,000 or so podcasts? You don't remember exactly every story you told. So if you've heard this story before, I hope you indulge me to tell it again, and hopefully it'll be enjoyable again. After I tell that story, I'm going to follow up with an interesting documentary film that I'm going to point you to that begins talking about the rise and fall of Kodak, the film company, and then gets into the camera business as a whole, digital photography coming onto the scene, all that good stuff. So I sort of feel like the two sort of come together. You know, they kind of work together. My beginnings, Kodak's rise and fall. The nice thing is I haven't really had the fall part of it. I just had a really slow rise. It just took many, many years. You may be wondering what even made me think of all this stuff. And today, as I record this, Monday, August 11th, it's my mom's birthday. And if she were with us right now, she would be 90 years old. So our family has a tradition, and we usually touch base on my mom's birthday and on my dad's birthday too, who has also passed away. And so I sent my sister a text this morning, you know, saying, "Happy birthday, Mom." She had been thinking about Mom too, and so she wrote me back, and we reminisced just a little bit. It was kind of nice. I mean, my sister is one of the touchstones in my life. As we were just sort of reminiscing about Mom and how much we've been thinking about her, it got me thinking about other things too. And it's funny how the brain works. One thing leads to another. And suddenly I was thinking about my roots in photography and how my mom supported that without really understanding it. And I thought that was always such an interesting thing. And, you know, when you become a parent yourself, you sort of get your head around it a little bit better, that it's impossible to always understand what's going on with our kids. You know, at the same time, when they're really passionate about something, you feel compelled to support them in their passion. And I think that's where my parents were, both my mom and my dad, but especially my mom. Now, Uncle Don, the artist, musician, inventor, photographer, that was her uncle. So I think that it wasn't that far flung for her to think, well, maybe Derek got a little bit of Uncle Don in him as well, and we might as well see where this goes. And I'm so glad they did, because I can't think that I'd want to do anything else right now with my life. So that's all sort of the setting on how I got here. So let's talk about that road right now. And what we're going to do is we're going to go to my eighth grade year. And I was hanging out with a kid in drafting class, and his name was Bill McCombs. And Bill McCombs and I had known each other for a while. We were friends, and we continued being friends in the first part of high school as well. And Bill was a boy that had access to things that I did not. I was shooting with my Argus C3, and Bill was shooting with a Pentax Spotmatic, I believe. And I would look at his camera and I would just go, oh my gosh, how did you get that? You know, it was amazing. He had different lenses for it and all of that. Well, I soon learned that Bill's dad was the publisher of the local newspaper, and it was called the Chino Champion. I was living in Chino, California at the time. That's where I grew up, in Southern California. And his dad was the publisher of the local paper. So not only did Bill have a Pentax Spotmatic, he also had a dark room at his house, a real dark room, not a corner in the garage like I had with a sheet, and I had to wait till it's completely dark outside. And then, of course, there was all the dust from the garage itself, and I didn't have an enlarger. Well, you get the picture. Bill had a full-fledged dark room at his house. I mean, it was off the garage, but it had a sealed door, and you walked inside, and there was big trays on a counter that drained. He had an Omega enlarger, really nice safe light, ventilation, places to hang the film, a sink to rinse things out and wash and all that. I mean, it was everything in there. It was amazing. And in fact, because his dad ran a newspaper business, he also had a rapid print processor. And this was amazing to me. I had never seen anything like it. But it had a bath and a bunch of rollers. I guess it had a couple baths, I think. And you would do the exposure on the paper, and then you would turn on this processor, and you would just feed it into the spinning rollers, and the print, the paper would go in one thing and go down into one bath, down into another bath, and then come out the other side developed. Developed. It was crazy. So we had both trays and the rapid print processor, and I was in heaven. I loved going to Bill's house after school and playing around in the dark room, raiding the kitchen. The mom had things stocked in there that my mother would never keep in the house. So it was a food heaven as well. And he had a swimming pool. He had a swimming pool on top of everything else. And it wasn't just one of those little kidney-shaped swimming pools. This was a big rectangular swimming pool that you could actually, if you wanted to, swim laps in. As you can imagine, I valued my friendship with Bill McCombs immensely as an eighth grader. Summer came along early that year. I believe it was in May. And it was really hot out. I mean, it was hot, hot out. It was Southern California hot. There were some kids over at the house, at Bill McCombs' house, and I was there. and everyone was in the pool, splashing around. There was various inflatables in there. There was, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it was fun. And I was there and I was going, this is really neat. This is kind of a cool thing here. And since Bill had a two-story house, what I decided to do was take my Argus C3, go up to the second deck, and take a picture of all this happening, all this fun, all the kids playing in a pool in the middle of a heat wave, and take some pictures. I believed I had some Kodak Plus X in there in my Argus C3, which is really nice ASA 160, I believe. I took a number of shots. I mean, I think I had like maybe two or three frames already exposed, and I finished it off. I finished off a whole roll of kids playing around. So when the party kind of subsided and some other kids went home and stuff, I used to hang around Bill's house and sometimes I'd have dinner there. His mom, Gretchen, she really liked me a lot and she encouraged me to hang around as much as possible. We decided to process that film, that roll of film that I had shot. So we go into the dark room and we do our thing. And he had these nice steel tanks, not like the plastic ones I had. He had stainless steel reels, and they were really nice. He would just arc it a little bit, the film a little bit, and just roll it onto these reels. And we were using Accufine Developer. He always had Accufine Developer, and I think that was partly because of the newspaper business. Accufine pushed film really well if he needed to, and that's why we had it. So we developed this roll of film and rinsed it and all that sort of stuff and hung it up in there and then left the dark room and went back to being kids. I don't know. We were doing something, playing around, I think just sort of killing time until dinner was ready. And his dad gets home. He apparently had to do something in the dark room. And so he went into the dark room while we were playing and he came out of the dark room and found us. And he was holding the roll of film that I had hanging up. And he goes, whose roll of film is this? When you're an eighth grade kid, especially in those days, someone asks you a question like this, you immediately start thinking of an excuse or a way to push the blame somewhere else or anything, right? I couldn't think of anything. So I just said very feebly, that's my roll of film. We shot it today while the kids were playing in the pool. And then I just waited. I waited to hear, like, how dare you use, you know, the chemicals for the newspaper for your own silliness or, you know, whatever. I was just waiting for some sort of admonishment. And he goes, there are some really nice shots on here. And, ooh, okay. Whew, maybe I'm not going to get punished and sent home without dinner. And he said, I want to run a story about this heat wave that we're in, and one of these pictures, maybe more, would go really nice with that story. Would you be okay if we did that? If I printed a few of these and we ran them, I would give you photo credit, of course. And I was like, yeah, definitely. Yes. You know, fantastic. I mean, this was beyond my wildest dream. Remember, I had been already in love with photography for quite a while. He went ahead and he ran a couple of my pictures with the story. The story looked really good, I thought. And it was a nice piece about the heat wave and when they thought it would end and how people are coping with it, all that good stuff. The sort of thing that you would see in a local newspaper. As it turned out, after that story ran, he offered me a job. He said, would you like to be a stringer? Take pictures, you know, for little assignments that we had here and there. And mainly he was thinking of like high school football games, recreational stuff. Summer was coming in, and so there was a big recreational program in Chino, and he wanted some kind of human interest stories, you know, of kids doing various activities and all that. I was paid by the column inch. He offered me pay by the column inch. So the number of column inches that your story would occupy on any given page of the paper, you were paid so much per column inch, and that's how you made your money. And so I was both writing the stories and taking the pictures for the Chino Champion. I did this well into high school. I became a yearbook photographer in high school, and that was occupying a lot of my time and quite honestly. This is a little bit of foreshadowing. I also got some other jobs that paid a lot more than working for the Chino Champion. And so I sort of evolved out of that first job, but I had it on my resume, young resume that it was, and it helped me get the yearbook photographer job, which I did for 3 years. And then after that, I just kept going. I had one photography job or writing job after another. But the very first job that gave me my confidence and was my first entry onto my resume was that job for the Chino Champion, thanks to Al McCombs and his son Bill, and a very hot summer day in an Argus C3 that my Uncle Don had gifted me. This documentary traces the rise and deep fall of the camera industry. And this is an article you can find on petapixel.com, and I have a link to it, and I want to talk about it as well. I'll read you a little bit about what they say, and then I'll talk about what I noticed when I watched this film, which I was fascinated with, to tell you the truth. I really thought I knew a lot about the evolution of the camera industry, and I learned some more. Kodak, Olympus, and Fujifilm, The Rise and Deep Fall of the Camera Industry, examines how three iconic camera brands navigated success and decline, technological shifts, and strategic decisions that ultimately shaped the fate of these once dominant companies. The life and death battles of global businesses, the fatal decisions, the risks taken, the mistakes made inside the boardroom. This is how the video begins. In over 2-hour-long documentary-style video, Kodak, Olympus, and Fujifilm, The Rise and Deep Fall of the Camera Industry by FD Finance, the intricacies of the camera industry's evolution are examined through the lens of three iconic brands, Kodak, Olympus, and Fujifilm. The video takes viewers on a journey through the successes and eventual struggles of these titanic players in photography, providing a comprehensive perspective on how technological shifts, business missteps, and market dynamics reshaped the photographic landscape. It utilizes insights from industry experts, video interviews, press coverage, and archival footage to trace the namesake rise and fall of each company, offering a well-rounded narrative of their journeys and the factors that influenced their fates. Kodak's story is perhaps the most famous cautionary tale in the world of photography. Once the dominant player in film and camera manufacturing, Kodak's early innovations, such as the first handheld cameras and introduction of color film, cemented its place as a household name. However, the company's downfall is often attributed to its failure to adapt to the rise of digital photography, a sector in which it was an early pioneer but ultimately failed to embrace. Then they moved to Olympus, and the Olympus subtitle is Olympus from Camera Excellence to Corporate Scandal. Olympus made its mark in the world of photography in the 1970s. The company continued innovating with breakthrough products right till the 2000s. But then an auditing scandal came to light, causing an internal crisis. Inside the Storm, Back from the Brink, reveals how Olympus overcame the odds, the film says. Olympus, known for its high-quality cameras and groundbreaking innovations like the first mirrorless interchangeable lens camera, also faced its own set of challenges. In the video, FD Finance explains how Olympus was able to stay relevant through technological advancements for a long time, even surviving the early 2000s digital revolution. However, Olympus's story took a dark turn with the revelation of a massive corporate scandal in 2011, which shook the company's financial foundation and led to a public image crisis. The scandal involving fraudulent accounting practices resulted in the loss of consumer trust and a decline in market share. Despite efforts to recover and refocus on medical technology, Olympus camera division gradually diminished, culminating in the sale of the camera business to Japan Industrial Partners in 2020 and a rebirth as OM System, which continues to honor the Olympus legacy through new cameras and lenses. And then the final player here in this movie, Fujifilm, reinventing itself for the modern age. Fujifilm presents a different narrative from Kodak and Olympus, Unlike its competitors, Fujifilm very successfully navigated the transition from film to digital. It was an international brand with profits in the millions, but in the turn of the millennium, Fujifilm was standing on unstable ground. Inside the Storm, Back from the Brink interviews the people directly involved, uncovering the decisions and risks taken to keep the iconic brand alive. All right, so it covers all of these, and then it gets into the broader implications for the camera industry. I just put this on. It's a YouTube video. I just put it on the laptop, and I have it playing when I'm doing things like, you know, putzing around, doing a little bit of business accounting, answering email, whatever, you know, whatever is going on where I can multitask and just let it run. And there have been moments where I found it so interesting that I actually would stop what I was doing and just watch the video. I also watched it during my breakfast and lunch break. It's a fascinating stuff. And it was very interesting. Like, one of the parts that you'll see in the beginning, if you watch this, is that one of the lead technology engineers for Kodak, who saw the future in digital photography, who tried to get it going within Kodak, who ended up setting up a secret lab in Japan to, you know, further explore this, and then eventually left the company because Kodak wasn't ready to follow his lead, and then went to work for Apple and helped Apple launch their first digital camera. And of course, we know what happened from there after that. And you just sort of watch these things happen. You watch how Fujifilm approached evolution much different than Kodak and how they were able to survive. It's a fascinating film. It's well worth the time to watch it. And like I said, you can just have it on your laptop, watch it for a little bit, pause it, you know, do other stuff, come back to it the next day, whatever you want. But I think you'll find it really educational and informative. And for me, it helped me understand even more what's going on today by understanding how these three companies, Kodak, Olympus, and Fujifilm, responded to these challenges. It's a good film, and I think you'll enjoy it. The Ricoh GR4 nears its release. New specs, features, and design. Is this the most refined compact camera yet? And you'll find this article on Digital Camera World. Let me read you a little bit about it, and then you can finish up by following the link in the show notes. The most anticipated compact camera is nearly here, with fresh images, specs, and feature upgrades now revealed. The Ricoh GR4 is shaping up to be a game changer. Ricoh unveiled the new details and images of its upcoming GR4 compact camera, which is set to launch in the fall of 2025. The follow-up HDF model is also in the pipeline. With this new information available, it's clear that the next generation compact camera is designed to push creative boundaries across multiple photography styles, from street and travel photography to documentary, event, close-up, and experimental shooting. Many photographers felt that the Ricoh GR3 and the GR3X and HDF variants were beginning to show their age, particularly given the price tag. So is Ricoh answering the calls for a more substantial innovation with its GR4? As reported by Webio user Camera Obsession and highlighted by Pentax rumors, fresh insights into highly anticipated Ricoh GR4 were shared during a recent presentation in China. Finally, news that offers us a much clearer picture of what to expect. The previous GR3 offered great image quality with its 24-megapixel sensor, but the GR4 comes equipped with a new 25.74-megapixel APS-C CMOS sensor paired with a GR Engine 7 processor, promising higher quality shots. And this time the lens is composed of 7 elements in 5 groups and a built-in 2-stop ND filter, a feature also found in its predecessor. One of the most requested upgrades was better autofocus performance. With the GR4, Ricoh brings a new focus algorithm, significantly improving low light focus speed, face detection, and continuous tracking function. These enhancements expand the GR4's versatility and could appeal to shooters beyond the street photography genre. Another major improvement is the introduction of 5-axis image stabilization alongside expanded high ISO capabilities, both of which promise better low-light shooting and smoother handheld performance. While the GR3 was limited to 4 frames per second burst shooting, there has been no word regarding an update. Even a jump to 10 frames per second would be a welcome change. As for video, the GR4 remains capped at 1080p at 60 frames per second, with no 4K option stated. However, for street photographies, Ricoh's introducing a new SN street shooting mode. The exposure compensation button returns to the thumb position and the quick control dial has been replaced with a cross key layout for greater precision. One feature many continue to hope for is weather sealing, an omission in the GR series so far. While there's no confirmation on this, it's becoming harder to justify its absence, especially in an era where smartphones offer basic weather resistance. As the fall launch approaches, excitement continues to build, but one of the biggest questions remains unanswered: what will the Ricoh GR4 cost? With its improved specs, sleeker design, and broader creative potential, the GR4 could mark a step forward in Ricoh's compact series, provided the price lands at the right place. Alrighty, so here we go. We're expecting, not very far away, honestly, right? The Ricoh GR4. This is a terrific camera. I mean, I have shot with a number of the GRs. I even shot with them back in the film days when they were film models. I love shooting with this camera. It has a look, especially in the black and white, that I particularly appreciate. So easy to carry around, you know, and then having that nice big sensor in such a small camera, it just really feels like a luxury. And I think that this one, depending on what the final specs are and what the final prices are, is going to be a welcome camera. And today's surge of high-end compact cameras, which are as popular as they've been in a while, seems like a good time to release the GR4. All right, stick care of a little virtual camera club business. I want to start out by acknowledging our Inner Circle members, both Inner Circle and Inner Circle Bold, the folks that support this podcast in this community month in and month out, not only with their patronage, but also with their sharing of thoughts, ideas, pictures, and just overall support, you know, ideas. It's really great when you have a group of people who are enthusiastic about this endeavor and who push forward and just show their support and just kind of keep this thing going in the right direction. That's what our Inner Circle members do. If you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member and joining this fine group of artists, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can sign up there, and then the next thing you know, you'll be receiving email from me giving you access to our Inner Circle space on Derek's Story Online, and of course, your discounts to upcoming photography workshops. A big thanks to our Inner Circle members for supporting us. I also want to acknowledge our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story, the folks that have everything we need for making fine art archival prints that stand the test of time. You know, it's interesting when you watch the movie that I was talking about earlier that starts off with Kodak and they're talking about, you know, the importance of the prints and how you want to capture the moments of life and then how prints were the way that we were able to share them with other people. Of course, that evolution then went to digital photography and sharing through social media and other means, but that the print remains an important part of our photographic history, and it tickles a different part of the brain than looking at a picture on an iPhone or on a computer or some other way. And that persists to this day. There's something different about an image when you see it as a print compared to a digital image. Of course, Red River Paper knows about all of this, and they provide us with all the tools that we need to produce great prints on their website. And they provide us with the great paper that we need to interpret our images so that we can match the paper to the mood and to the message that we want conveyed with that image. And that combination of paper surface and paper texture with the image itself, that's something that is just very difficult, if not impossible, to do on a digital screen. And you can do this with paper, and when you pull it off, it's magical. Red River Paper has a tile on all the pages of the digital story, and I encourage you to go there, click on it, nose around a bit, make sure you note our discount code for free shipping, get yourself some paper, and start making some magic. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.